I'm Carrie Sheffield. I'm the founder of Bold, a bipartisan digital television network on the web. We are committed to bringing the country together, to sparking conversations that inspire and empower people. You should treat uncertainty as your friend and to not think of it as something to be avoided or something to shrink from, but uncertainty is actually the condition in which you must succeed. It's not a condition that you avoid. It is actually going straight into the fire, because if it was easy, someone would have already done it.
This is Secrets of Wealthy Women from the Wall Street Journal, helping women empower themselves financially. Now, Veronica Dagger.
Writer and political analyst Carrie Sheffield founded her own digital news network, Bold TV. She explains how the media industry continues to be a challenge for women entrepreneurs and how she forges ahead anyway. Carrie, you had said as a child you grew up in poverty. Would you tell us about that?
Sure. So my parents are very devout religious Mormons. And they, in my early childhood, didn't think that we should have a lot of the materialistic things, because the things of the spirit were so much more important. And so we lived a very transitory life. I went to 17 public schools and homeschool. In my early age in particular is when we had really high poverty. My parents were on welfare at one point. My brother was born in a tent when we were living in a tent in a campground. And it was really trying to follow my dad's beliefs, and that's what we did. So it was a lot of chaos and a lot of interesting moments. I'll write a book about it.
How did that affect your view of money?
I think that it, because as I said, you know, the concept was that we were really supposed to seek after spiritual riches, that money was something to be almost in some ways afraid of, because it was a corrosive influence, that the Bible says, you know, the love of money is at the root of all evil. So I think there was this sense that if you were seeking or chasing after money, that you were shallow, or that you were worldly, or that you didn't have depth. And so I think that affected my perception earlier in my young adulthood. And I had to kind of reprogram myself to say, okay, you know what? I think money could actually be something that is used to help the world. But it's like anything else, like a tool. It's like technology. Technology can be used for good or can be used for evil. And to really empower myself to see that money isn't something to be afraid of. It's just making sure that you know who you are and that you're using money for good.
How did you reprogram yourself?
Took a long time. But one thing that was really helpful for me was I got into the concept of Stoicism. And Stoicism is an ancient school of philosophy that teaches you that life is really about how you react to things, instead of about, you know, that phrase, like, life is, you know, only 10% what happens to you and 90% how you react to it. And I the more I read about Stoicism and the more I learned about this concept of you know, you are the master of your universe. You're the master of your thoughts. You're the master of how you respond to the environment around you. That really empowered me. So that was a big part of it. And so I'd recommend that to all of your listeners if you're looking to reprogram yourself, to know there's a formula in a book that I read, ABC. There's an activating event, there's a belief about that event, and there's a consequence about that event. And so many times people just think of the world as it's all happening to me, instead of which is an activating event. And then they have a belief about that event. And the C is the consequence or the cognitive process about that event. And most people skip that B part. They don't know that they actually have the power to change their belief about what's happening. They think that the stimuli and their emotional response are basically interconnected and you don't have control over it. And so the more I understood and was able to kind of break down that formula, the more empowered I felt to think about money, that it was something that didn't have to control me. I could control my response to it.
You were raised Mormon, then left the church. How did you get the strength to do that?
So it was really hard. I wrote about my experience in the Washington Post. Family pressure, just because, you know, my ancestors had helped to found the Mormon church. And there are lots of aspects of the church that I still admire. I still have lots of family who are still in it. But for me, I just felt that the concepts and the belief in the afterlife of polygamy, that was a big sticking point for me. As a woman, I just didn't think that it was inherently fair that I, in the afterlife, ostensibly could just be one of many wives. To me, that doesn't sound like heaven. That just sounded like hell. So, and I didn't even have the option to have multiple husbands if I wanted. Not that I wanted them. I just thought it was inherently sexist. So that was a big part thing that I didn't like. But I think even more broadly than that, I had issue with the way that the church talked about its history and its founder. I felt like there wasn't transparency and there wasn't an encouragement of honest, open dialogue about the church's founding. I felt that they whitewashed a lot of things that were happening in the early days and created these mythologies that were not giving the full picture to people. And I felt, and it's interesting to see that a lot of younger people now, you know, from my millennial generation, they've felt the same way when we discover things on the internet that our church leaders didn't tell us. And they're true. And we go to the library or we just do some actual research that isn't from the official textbooks from the church or the official handbooks. There's this huge dichotomy of what the church teaches you and what the science and the historical facts are about the founding. And so I just felt like in some ways, I've said this before, that it was almost like Richard Nixon with the break-in with Watergate, that the cover-up was in some respects worse than the crime, a lot of observers say. That's how I felt about Mormonism, that, you know, the founder was a human, but they whitewashed a lot of his flaws and things that he had done that were, in my opinion, pretty questionable. So I just didn't like that, the whitewashing of it. And so I didn't feel like I could continue in that environment. And so also I'm my journalistic training, I like to ask questions, and I think the church is trying to open up and be more transparent about it, but I have too many questions, and I also am not the biggest fan of how historically they've treated LGBT Mormons, and that upset me also.
About 3 years ago, you started the online digital network Bold. How did you know you wanted to be an entrepreneur?
Well, I've heard a lot of entrepreneurs say this, that it really came out of frustration with the current offerings and just wanting to fulfill a need that wasn't being met. And so for me, I didn't see a place where we had a digital news conversation that was socially native, that was speaking to the millennial generation and was giving messages that were outside of what was in the current offering and the current media environment of how just combative things can be.
What role do you think digital news networks are going to have in the overall media landscape?
I think it's tough to be one of the first movers. And, you know, we've seen that. I mean, and even the bigger established brands see this, too. It's that migration of the advertising dollars. There's always that lag time. It was the same going from radio to network to cable and just that slog of the revenue. And so from cable then to digital. And our fierce headwinds are the technology companies, because that's where a lot of the revenue's going, is to your Googles and your Facebooks. And that's a whole other ball of wax that traditional media companies didn't have to grapple with. And the constant tension in some respects, frenemies, or, you know, working with the tech companies because they own a lot of the pipeline of how to reach people. How do we have leverage as content companies? And I think Rupert Murdoch has not been shy. He's a very bold guy in how he's negotiated and been very vocal about his views of how the content companies should be compensated for what they're creating.
Do you think the online digital networks replace cable companies?
It will probably be just a bit more like what we have, because we still have traditional network. You've got the three, CBS, NBC, and ABC, and then you've also got cable. So I think that cable will be around. It's just that we'll have more digital players, too. And what that constellation will look like will constantly be shifting and evolving. We still have radio. It's just in a different format. It's Pandora, or it's streaming, and it's on the web. So I wouldn't say replace entirely. I think it will supplement it and be alongside it. And the socially native aspect, I think, is a whole other new dimension, because it does give the viewer and the consumer more power and more choice. And because of the nichification of media, this is where the problem of people just getting into their own echo chambers, that's what I'm concerned about from a societal aspect.
Coming up, Carrie Sheffield explains how she stays true to her vision despite all the noise.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
You're listening to Secrets of Wealthy Women from the Wall Street Journal.
Women have a more difficult time getting funding for their startups. How did you do it?
Well, it's interesting. I would tell your listeners who are grappling with these issues, even if you're having a hard time finding funding for your startup, think about it this way, that you have a purpose for what you're doing, and that purpose is very valuable, and you don't want to auction that off to the highest bidder. And to also not confuse the ability to raise money with the ability to create a successful company. The venture capital model, in some respects, especially in the content space, puts such intense pressure that we've taken the opposite route. We've really grown organically and bootstrapped and been able to find sponsors in real time and grow organically. And yes, it's smaller, but I compare it to, you know, the Aesop's tortoise and the hare, that if you can grow your company sustainably, you're going to be there for the long haul.
Bold faced a trademark dispute with two giant media companies, which Bold won. What trademark advice would you give to other entrepreneurs?
Yes. we were profiled by Entrepreneur Magazine about this dispute, and the editor-in-chief said what I did was stupid. So that's a great ringing endorsement, because he was right. And so if I can help any of your listeners with their trademarks beforehand and get out in front of it, it would be to file your trademark before you launch. So what had happened was we had launched, and I knew about the concept of common law trademark, and I never expected that these two enormous companies with a combined market cap of $20 billion would one day try to take my company's name. So it really was a miracle. It was one of those David versus Goliath scenarios. But because we had been so effective at driving the news cycle and getting newsmakers and proving ourselves as a brand, we were able to defeat this dispute. So if I had to do it all over again, I would have filed the trademark for Bold TV as a digital streaming news network before our launch. That would be my big advice for you. Just do it. You know, I once you start your company, there are so many moving parts, and that just ended up being on the back burner. We were very lucky, and that's what they said in the podcast, that it was an IP lawyer on to talk about the case, and he said it was exceptionally rare that we were able to pull out this victory. So protect yourself. File your trademark before you launch.
Some women have given up their startups because they've had a difficult time keeping dates or having a personal life. What advice would you give them?
Oh, boy. I don't know if I'm your girl for this one. I was actually just named on Bumble's Most Inspiring New Yorkers list, and they did this big multimedia campaign, and you know, they hired us people on their list to do their photo shoot. And I actually had more luck with their business app because they have three verticals on Bumble: Bumble Dating, Bumble Business, and Bumble BFF, which is platonic friends. And the one guy that I liked on Bumble ended up moving to the other side of the world in another country and married someone else. And so delete the dating vertical, and we actually ended up hiring someone on the business vertical for Bumble. So I guess in that respect, I'm not the best example. But I would say, from my experience, find a guy who understands your purpose, because that's why you started your company. And if you don't have that partner who really is completely understands you, they're not going to be able to, they're not going to be strong enough. Like that song, "Are you strong enough to be my man?" It takes a man who has incredible depth to appreciate that. So I'm still looking.
What's your advice for women who are struggling with the uncertainty of a startup life?
Yeah, I think going back to what I mentioned about Stoicism, one of the concepts they have is amor fati, which means to love your fate. And a big part of that is to love uncertainty, that you should treat uncertainty as your friend and to not think of it as something to be avoided or something to shrink from. But uncertainty is actually the condition in which you must succeed. It's not a condition that you avoid. It is actually going straight into the fire, because if it was easy, someone would have already done it. So the whole reason you're doing a company is because you're trying to do something different and innovative, and that inherently involves uncertainty. Otherwise, you know, just stick to the regular job.
You learn that people believe in people who believe in themselves. What do you mean by that?
I had someone tell me once that bold was bad for students' brains. And so to sit through that sort of meeting and to keep a smile on your face, no matter what they're saying, because there are other people in the room, decision makers, who are still listening to you, and maybe you're not going to be in that division, but there's someone else who if you believe in what you're saying, you will break through. So it goes back to the math, really. The statistical odds of your company succeeding are pretty slim. I'm sure you have all these great stats here at the Journal of how many businesses fail. Only, 10% perhaps survive. So you have to be kind of crazy to actually believe that you're going to be in that 10%, much like my dear friend Clay Aiken on American Idol, to believe that you will be that one. And people voted. Well, he came in second, but a lot of them voted for him because he believed in what he was doing.
You say women often get intimidated when it comes to money. What do you mean by that?
We sometimes think of money as, myself coming from a very traditional, male-female world background, that I didn't think of money as something that I was necessarily going to manage. I know, I have five brothers, and they were allowed to have jobs outside the home, paper routes, other things. I was not allowed to have a job, so I wasn't allowed to have any income coming in, even though I wanted to, but just was not allowed. And so that was one of those mental patterns that I had to get over, that somehow men might find me intimidating if I knew how to manage money. So I think that's part of it. I think also, we oftentimes will take the mommy track, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. But if you're not the primary breadwinner, it could be a different calculus in terms of how you think about money. And so I think to, again, think of money as a tool. It's value neutral. It's all about how you approach it. I think that could be empowering for women.
What's the biggest personal finance lesson you've learned?
The power of diversification and the power of making sure that you really understand an investment. Because what had happened was I had gotten a sum of inheritance from my grandfather at age 23. But given that I had grown up in a lot of trailer parks and not being exposed to having a job or money, I had no idea what to do with it. And so I put it into one of my uncle's, his investments, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was so preoccupied with my job, and it was, and I love my uncle, and I still love him, but I had not really taken the time to understand this investment, and it was a very speculative, risky investment, and I ended up losing a lot of the value of the investment, and it was a big wake-up call for me to realize how much I had surrendered my power. And to it was part of actually why I pivoted my major into business at the Harvard Kennedy School to study business policy, because I realized how little that I knew about money, and how I actually thought of people who thought a lot about money as, going back to my childhood programming, that they were superficial or they were kind of wasting their time when they could have been, in my case, for example, focused on public policy and politics and serving the world. But if you don't have the financial means to do it, you're not going to serve the world. So it's really finding that balance.
You said you're a registered independent who often votes Republican. What do you say to women who say it's in conflict to be a woman and a Republican or vote Republican?
Yeah, well, funny story, because I have said this quite a bit, that I'm registered independent. I've decided to become a Republican because of Kavanaugh. I was so really distraught about what had happened with Kavanaugh, because I felt like the most fundamental human rights of right to trial and evidentiary process, as was outlined in things like the Magna Carta, dating back centuries, were being called into question. And I think that the Democratic Party has drifted so far to the left in these past couple of decades that I decided to become Republican. And yes, you're right that there are a lot of voices in the media and in our political dialogue right now that say that if you're a female Republican, that there's something wrong with you, that you're not a real woman, that you don't care about empowering women. And I would say to them, let's go get some coffee. Let's talk about this. Because I believe that Republican policies are very empowering for women, that, you know, as a businesswoman, to have a strong private sector is really the best way to promote human flourishing for both men and women and for children as well. But, you know, we're a bipartisan brand at Bold, so we debate all that.
Time now for your secrets.
I'm Carrie Sheffield, the founder of Bold, and my money secret is to always live below your means. That way you will always have enough.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out more episodes of Secrets of Wealthy Women on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast provider. And be on the lookout for our upcoming ebook based on the Secrets of Wealthy Women podcast. This episode was produced by Tanya Bustos. I'm Veronica Dagger. Thanks for listening.